Good afternoon or evening, depending on where you are. This is Albert Wu, session number 4 of the WHO Patient Safety Introductory Research Course. And our topic today is understanding causes. We are, for the first time, broadcasting both using GoToMeeting and the Doodle network. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Maybe it's Doodle. And if anyone is listening to Doodle, if you could send a note through to say that you are hearing me, that would be terrific. Let me introduce myself very briefly. I'm a professor of health policy at Johns Hopkins, the School of Public Health, and I very recently was a senior advisor to WHO in Geneva. For those of you on Doodle, you can see me. I may be distracted for a minute because I am actually looking at two screens, one on one PC for GoToMeeting and one for you. So if I am not looking directly into the camera, please do not. I hope your feelings are not hurt. I also will need to change the slides on both computers. If there are little delays, please forgive me. Well, let me start with our introduction. Measuring what goes wrong in healthcare involves counting how many patients are harmed or even killed each year and from which types of adverse events. And this is something that we discussed at our session number 3 last week. If you are interested, you can find this on the WHO Patient Safety website. And it's been recorded. Now, once priority areas have been identified, the next step is to understand the underlying causes of adverse events. We'd like to understand these causes so that we can figure out perhaps what we might do next, and that will be the subject of our subsequent lectures. This slide shows the components of the research cycle in patient safety. The first component is measuring harm. We talked about that last week. The component we are talking about today is understanding causes. In subsequent lectures, we'll talk about identifying solutions, evaluating impact, and translating evidence into safer care. So this is a little pretest. See if you think you know the answers to these questions. Question 1, provider surveys can be useful for understanding causes of adverse events because, ended questions, B, they capture the wisdom of frontline healthcare workers, C, they can be used in developing and transitional country settings, D, all of the above. Question 2. Which of the following is not a self-reported method of data collection? A, surveys completed online. B, review of hospital charts. C, one-on-one interviews. D, focus groups. A few more questions. 3, which statement about reviewing malpractice claims is false? A, malpractice claims analysis can be good at finding latent errors. B, malpractice claims data are very representative of problems in medical care. C, malpractice claims are not standardized in format. D, malpractice claims provide data from multiple perspectives. Question 4, Which of the following methods can be useful for studying causes of adverse events? One, or A, provider surveys, B, incident reporting, C, cohort studies, D, all of the above. Final question. Incident reporting systems are A, good for finding latent errors, B, the best method for understanding the causes of adverse events, C, also referred to as reporting and learning systems, D, A, and C. See if you can think of the answers to those, and we'll review these at the end of the lecture. I'd like to start with a brief case. This was unfortunately a real incident. This was a post-operative patient. He had had a revision of a sternal wound infection, so this was not clean surgery, and he needed a prophylactic antibiotic. It needed to be given quickly, best if it's given before the surgery, but he still needed it to be given. He is penicillin allergic, and this is written on his chart. The doctor wrote an order for Tymentin, that's a brand name for ticarcillin. The antibiotic was given by the nurse. The patient had an anaphylactic reaction and cardiac arrest and died. So a terrible case. There was at least one error, and there was an adverse event, the patient's cardiac arrest. This is James Reason's Swiss cheese model for how things go wrong and defenses. And when this case was analyzed, a few things were noted. The first was that after the medication order was written, the nurse had borrowed the medication from another patient's drawer, and this was what was given to the patient. And this was also an error. One would think that perhaps both the physician who wrote the incorrect prescription, perhaps he didn't realize that Tymentin was a penicillin, since Tymentin doesn't sound like a cillin, and the nurse broke a rule. She didn't go to the pharmacy, or she didn't get the medicine from the pharmacy. So one of the defenses these medications is the pharmacy checks and says, oh, you can't give this to the patient. He's allergic. But by borrowing the medication, the nurse bypassed the pharmacy, and that protective layer, that slice of cheese, could not protect the patient. So it turns out there were other problems. One was the fax system, which was used for ordering medications immediately, STAT, was broken. And so it couldn't be used. There was a tube system that sent orders, but that was broken too. There actually had been a runner who ran emergency prescriptions to the pharmacy, but that position had been eliminated. So what the nurse did was quite logical in some ways. She knew there were these problems, and the fastest way to fix the problem was a workaround. That is, she did something which was against the rules, but which was faster. She then gave the medicine to the patient. The patient was allergic to it and unfortunately arrested and died. Also, another problem was that the ICU was short of patients. There were too many patients, and the nurse was taking care of several patients at the same time, making it easier not to notice, not to check the chart, and not to notice. So what should we do in this case to fix the problem? You could tell the nurses and the doctors to be more careful. You could educate them to be careful about medication allergies. You could make a policy. Maybe you should fire the nurse or the doctor. However, none of those is likely to make things safer because there were many elements in the system which were broken and which allowed this incident, the error of the physician and the error of the nurse, to happen. And in fact, it caused them to make more errors. This is the funnel of levels of the patient, of the medical care system, the hospital care system, that was described by Charles Vincent. And he describes layers that include the patient, the task being done, individual provider behaviors or actions, team factors, work environment factors, department factors, and hospital and even higher institutional factors. There can be problems, latent errors, in all of these places, and then when there's an active error, like a doctor writing a wrong order or a nurse giving a medicine that the patient's allergic to, it's easier for these things to happen because of all the other factors at the different levels. And we need to understand what is happening at these levels in order to be able to figure out what we should fix to reduce risk for patients. Because it's not helpful just to say, be more careful. There are four basic methods for collecting data in medical research in general. We mentioned these last week and I'll review. One is direct observation of healthcare. The second is self-reports by interview or by questionnaires. And we will talk about that in detail, a little detail today. The third is testing, either asking people to do tests in front of you or actually taking blood tests or doing other laboratory investigations. And the final is physical evidence, reviewing documents. There are many measurement methods that can be used in patient safety. Some of them are prospective and some of them are retrospective, going forward or looking back. Prospective methods, some of which we talked about last week, direct observation of patient care, cohort studies, or clinical surveillance in which you build monitoring into care routines. Retrospective methods include record review, chart review, analysis of administrative claims like billing data, analysis of malpractice claims, which we'll talk about today, morbidity and mortality conferences with or without autopsy, and incident reporting systems, which we'll also talk about today. From this very nice paper by Eric Thomas and Laura Peterson in the Journal of General Internal Medicine, they discussed the relative utility of different methods to measure errors and the fact that certain methods were inherently better at detecting certain types of errors. Some methods are better at measuring and helping to understand latent errors. Some are better for capturing and understanding active errors or adverse events. Again, latent errors are those things that are designed into the system. They are often not visible, but they are system flaws that make it easier for errors to happen or easier for those errors to harm patients. Active errors are things that are done by frontline healthcare workers, and adverse events are injuries to patients due to errors or to healthcare. In this case, we can understand what's happening with latent errors very well using some of the methods, for example, incident reports, autopsies, or morbidity and mortality conferences. Helpful are chart review, administrative data analysis, and looking at information technology systems. All of the methods can be helpful, but these perhaps have greater potential to be helpful. Now, we're not talking about clinical analysis of single cases. Today we're talking about research, so I wanted to make that distinction. Clinical methods that are often used to investigate individual cases sometimes can be very informative to an institution to help them improve. So I want to talk about that for a second. The first method are morbidity and mortality conferences. I think that's a note to myself to insert a photo of a conference, which I did not do. And these are conferences where clinicians discuss cases that went wrong and ask different people to try to speculate on what might have gone wrong. Root cause analysis is done to figure out what happened and why. These are good for single cases at detecting latent errors, partly because they include information from multiple different providers. They can look at what happened over time, and they can look at what happened to the patient as they moved through the healthcare system, through the hospital, in different locations. Root cause analysis, which we won't talk about in detail today, looks at what happened in detail, perhaps creating a timeline and a chart for the events, and then tries to figure out why it happened, ways to prevent it from happening again, and how you will know you are safer in the future. Now, for research, we are usually interested in making multiple measurements or descriptions that can be analyzed statistically, so they can be generalized. That we're going to talk about today are surveys of healthcare staff, analyses of existing data to identify contributing factors, and prospective data collection using reporting systems or cohort studies. We're going to talk about reporting systems today and not so much about cohort studies, because we've talked about those before, and also because that method is perhaps a little more familiar to most people. The examples we're going to talk about are a case that is a our cases in this lecture are research studies of an anonymous survey of physicians. This was done by me, a malpractice claims analysis. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about reporting and learning systems, or incident reporting systems. In green, I mention cohort studies and an analysis of data are references to these studies at the end of the lecture, but we won't talk about them today since we have limited time. Leisure, and I would encourage you to do so. They're both, in many ways, classic studies of patient safety. So provider surveys. I have some advantages in green or blue there, and some disadvantages of this method in red. Provider surveys can be good for detecting latent errors, those errors that are built into the system. The data for this kind of incident is often not available, partly because providers know certain things about what's happening to the patient that's not recorded anywhere else. There's something which is called the wisdom of crowds, and that is the fact that people on the front lines collectively know a lot about what's happening in their institutions, and this is a way to tap the wisdom of crowds. There's an author called James Surowiecki who has written a book called The Wisdom of Crowds. And provider surveys can be comprehensive. They can ask about all levels of the system, about some levels of those systems and others. Some problems, surveys are prone to hindsight bias. People know what the outcome was, and they may tend to be more likely to judge the care to have been bad care because they know the outcome. for surveys too, it's very important to get a good response rate. If only a few people answer, you don't know if what they're saying is generalizable to all providers or to the institution. Different types of questions are often used. Some of them are closed-ended. These are the things that you tend to see on a survey. They have a set question, and then they have standard response categories that you can check off. Open-ended questions simply ask a very general question and invite you to give a response in any way you like, in free text. And semi-structured questions ask a slightly more directed question, a more specific question, and may ask, may give you choices about to choose from, or may allow you to give an open, free text response. This is the full citation for the paper, which was published in JAMA. It was called "Do House Officers Learn from Their Mistakes?" And it was from 1991. And there's an abstract that you can link to. For this study, the methods, in general, the design was a cross-sectional survey. It was a confidential and anonymous survey of physicians. We thought that was important because people might be nervous about talking about errors. It used both free text and fixed response questions, both open questions and fixed response questions. It was mailed out and mailed back, and if there was no reply, reminder postcards were sent, so this was done by mail. And the design was chosen to provide both in-depth responses and also the ability to get enough responses to be able to test some hypotheses. If you're hearing a siren, I apologize. We're right across the street from the hospital. Other self-report methods could have been used. We could have used semi-structured interviews with individual people, small group discussions with a circle of people, or focus groups, which are a special kind of small group discussion, or even one-on-one face-to-face interviews, kind of related to the semi-structured interviews. The setting was three large academic medical centers. The population were house officers. Those were young training clerks. You might call them registrars. In residency training programs in internal medicine. And of all of the people contacted, about half responded, and all of the people who responded reported a mistake that they had made. In fact, they were asked to report the worst mistake that they had made in the last 2 or 3 years, what happened to the patient, what happened to them, and what steps were taken to, what were some of the causes of the error, and what steps had been taken to try to fix the problem so that it would not happen again. Again, the data collection methods, this was a survey which we developed ourselves, which was mailed and then mailed back. The survey included a free text question, describe your most significant mistake in your response and responses to it. It included fixed response questions, which used adjective rating response scales. They asked people to agree or disagree. Coping, which was an existing, previously validated scale called the Ways of Coping instrument, and we used that. The survey was distributed to all of the house officers in this program. That was over 200. The package included a pen and a self-addressed postage-paid return envelope, and then they were given response postcards. They were asked to send back the postcard when they either had finished the survey or they decided they didn't want to do it and didn't want to be pestered anymore. That way, we would not know if they answered. it would still be confidential and anonymous when we got their survey, but we would not pester them anymore if they didn't want to be bothered. The key findings, there were serious adverse outcomes in 90% of the cases that were described, including death in almost a third. Now, this is not to say that the deaths were caused by the errors, but they might have been in some cases. House officers felt very badly. They felt afraid, remorseful, guilty, isolated, inadequate. Only half had told their supervising physician what happened, and only a quarter had told the patients or their families, and both of these, I think, were important things to know. They changed their practice. They were more likely to change their practice if they accepted responsibility personally for the mistake and discussed it. They were less likely to change practice if they attributed the mistake to job overload. And if the institution was very judgmental, they were more likely to be defensive and to do things like try to avoid talking about errors to anybody. I should have had another slide which said what some of the causes were. Frequent cause. They also described not knowing enough as a frequent cause of mistakes. Their supervision was not sufficient in some cases, they felt. In other cases, they had too many things to do all at the same time, too many patients to take care of at the same time. In other cases, they described they were fatigued. Some of the conclusions for this paper were that mistakes were frequent, and in fact, physicians knew about them and what happened and so could describe them. They included all different aspects of the clinical work that these doctors were doing. Interestingly, supervisors were often not told. And overwork was attributed as a cause for why some of these things happened. I can reflect that this type of study could easily be replicated in a developing country or a country with a transitional economy to undercover specific local setting, specific findings. I think that people who are working in hospitals know all sorts of things that no one else knows, and these could be very relevant to your own institution. They might be culturally you identify things that should be fixed in your organization. Malpractice claims. Malpractice claims have some advantages and some disadvantages. First, they're good for detecting latent errors, again, partly because there's information in those claims from multiple perspectives, from patients, from providers, and from lawyers. There is, again, hindsight bias. If there was a bad outcome, people are more likely to think that the care was bad, even if it might have been not so clear. There are reporting biases, and malpractice claims are not standardized. Different claims look differently. They're not all formatted in the same way. So it can be a little difficult to analyze them. I'm going to talk about for a minute about a study by Tejal Gandhi, which is called Missed and Delayed Diagnoses in the Ambulatory Setting, a Study of Closed Malpractice Claims. In an earlier slide, I think I might have made a mistake. The senior author for this study was David Studdert, but Tejal Gandhi was the first author of this paper. Again, you can link to the abstract . The design was a retrospective malpractice claims analysis. They did a review of closed claims and these were claims in which there was an allegation that the doctors had missed or delayed a diagnosis, and that these were things that happened in a clinic, not in the hospital itself. But they could have picked claims for in the hospital, for in the ICU, for procedural errors, for surgical errors. They just picked this kind of error. The objective was to develop a framework for investigating missed and delayed diagnoses in ambulatory settings. Diagnoses are a little harder to study, so this is perhaps a good way to study diagnoses or misdiagnoses. They wanted to advance the understanding of the causes of these kinds of errors and to identify opportunities to prevent them in the future. The setting data were from four big malpractice insurers, over 20,000 physicians, 46 hospitals, and 390 outpatient units. These were from 1984 to 2004, so they just took a sample of those claims. They wound up with 429 claims of that alleged a missed or delayed diagnoses, and they picked 307 for further analysis. These were all in the ambulatory or outpatient setting. The physician investigators, the people who wrote the paper, trained reviewers on what claim files looked like, how to use study instruments, which I will describe, and also on keeping confidentiality in collecting data. They developed some detailed manuals for how to extract information systematically out of the claims, and then they developed data forms to score whether or not something happened or did not happen. For all claims, insurance staff recorded administrative data for the case. So they actually had some staff people who said, what kind of patient was this? What kind of hospital was it? When did it happen? And the clinical reviewers recorded the details of the adverse outcomes the patient experienced. So these were nurses, physicians, or students. The reviewers first, when they looked at a malpractice claim, looked at the severity and how bad was the outcome from 1 to 9. Was it only emotional injury or ranging up to death? Secondly, they considered the role of a number of contributing factors, cognitive errors, system problems, even patient factors. Secondly, they judged whether or not they thought there was evidence that the adverse outcome that had happened was caused by a diagnostic error. And in some cases, they said that there was little evidence. And in other cases, they thought they were virtually certain that the adverse outcome that occurred had been due to a diagnostic error. And they dichotomized those claims that scored 4 or higher, more than 50-50 or a close call. They were classified as having that the adverse outcome was caused by a diagnostic error. For the claims that were judged to involve errors, they considered a defined sequence of diagnostic steps. So they knew the steps in general that are necessary to make a diagnosis. First, you take a history, then you do a physical examination, then you order tests, you make a plan for what should happen next. And they try to decide whether or not that there was a breakdown in that process. And they again judge that using closed ended categories from highly unlikely to highly likely that there had been a breakdown in that process. Their main findings, more than half, 59% of the claims where it in more than 59% of claims, it was judged that diagnostic errors had caused the adverse outcomes. They were serious harm in 59%. 30% of those cases were deaths, and cancer was actually a frequent problem. The most common breakdowns in the diagnostic process were failure to order an appropriate diagnostic test, failure to create a proper follow-up plan, failure to obtain an adequate history or perform an adequate physical examination, or incorrect interpretation of the diagnostic test results. So these were some of the causes, these were some of the errors, and perhaps you could think of some ways to try to fix these problems once you understood the causes. In general, per case of three, in other words, there's more than one breakdown per case. The most common contributing factors were failures in judgment, problems with vigilance or memory, lack of knowledge, some patient factors, like, for example, the patient didn't call back or didn't remember or didn't adhere, and then handoffs handovers, cases in which the patient goes from one provider to another and information is lost. So these are all common contributing factors, most of them in almost half of the cases. Their conclusions, diagnostic errors that harm patients and lead to malpractice claims are typically the result of multiple breakdowns, and knowing the common types of breakdowns and what's going wrong could help lead to strategies to prevent more diagnostic errors in the future. The authors reflect that their instruments were very long and they actually collected more data than they needed, so it is worth thinking about this as you're designing your study. Is it feasible in developing countries if there is medical legal information, for example, if there is an insurance company that has these information or a health complaints office, then those records could be analyzed as long as there is enough detail in those investigations. So potentially these could be used in developing countries if this kind of record was being collected somewhere. I'm going to talk briefly about reporting and learning systems or incident reporting systems. They're good at detecting latent errors. They can provide multiple perspectives over time because people observed what happened and are reporting back. They're retrospective. This could actually be made a standard procedure so that things are reported routinely. There is also reporting and hindsight bias in these cases. People know what they know and they don't know what they don't know, and so there's reporting bias. Only the things that they know or see are aware of are what they report. This shows a page from the Johns Hopkins Hospital website, which perhaps is a little bit more detailed than in some other places, but in particular, when you go to the website, you can click on PSN, Patient Safety Net, to report an event or service concern. So this is a online incident reporting system. You record some information, your name, where it happened, the patient's name, the patient's history number, the date and time of the event, what service it was on, did it happen on medicine or surgery, were there drugs involved in the incidents, list them, and then if there were some other questions about medication process. These are for a medication error, was it part of prescribing, dispensing, administration, Was there a problem in the record for what was administered? And you can check off that the wrong drug was ordered, the wrong frequency, an overdose, perhaps the wrong drug was dispensed, the wrong concentration was dispensed, a dose was missed, it was given to the wrong patient completely, and so forth. There are other drop downs for other different kinds of incidents. For example, a fall. There are specific questions about falls and detailed questions that ask about causes. The outcome is, there's a question about outcome. Did the patient event reach the patient? If it reached the patient, was there any treatment or monitoring necessary? If the event reached the patient, was the treatment needed? Was there a serious, life-threatening or serious consequence, or was this just a near miss? You can write comments, more comments about the case, and then you can submit online. Incidentally, this incident reporting system is attached to a pager system. So if a serious event, serious harm event is reported, someone's beeper actually goes off. But perhaps for our purposes, what you can do is you can look at a group of these incidents. People have gotten in the habit of making reports. So 10 or 15,000 of these incidents are reported every year, and you can analyze them to try to figure out, so for all of the cases that were false, for all of the cases that were medication errors, what were some of the causes, what were some of the common problems? So reporting and learning systems can have an investigative component that is built in ahead of time. Incidentally, you can ask people, what did you do to recover? What was done that prevented the consequences of the error? And when people report strategies, you can also learn from those strategies. You can learn from the ways in which people recovered in the field, in the natural setting. So what I'm going to try to do for just a few minutes, we'll see whether or not this works, is I'm actually going to I'm going to ask if anyone has a quick case for which you think there are factors that occurred at multiple levels. Do you have a case in which you think that there were contributing factors, perhaps at the patient level, at the level of the task that was being done, at the level of the provider, an error that was actually an active error, perhaps it was made by the provider? Did the team not function well? Were there things about the unit or the perhaps I could ask you to text in your cases. We can potentially discuss one of them. Let's see how this works. So I am looking at my screen and I am not seeing the question box, Doodle Forum, and I'm not seeing cases coming in. So at the moment, so maybe what we should do is, Mai, if you are getting any of these, if you could please collect them, and maybe at the end of the session, we can go over one of these. Let me go on for the moment. And let me summarize. So, you know, in summary for this lecture, different methods to understand errors and to understand errors and adverse events have different strengths and weaknesses. And we have talked today about some of the strengths and weaknesses of provider interviews or surveys, analysis of malpractice claims, and incident reporting systems. We also have other methods of cohort studies or direct observation, which we have discussed a little bit. Perhaps the best way to get a really comprehensive understanding of an incident is a mixed methods approach. And this is something that perhaps can give us the most different perspectives and help us improve our understanding the most. Here are some references. Again, and this is a large cohort study that looked at staffing rates. They actually did surveys also, and how it related to surgical patient outcomes, a cohort study which we didn't talk about today. Another paper we didn't talk about by Sean Barinholtz about using morbidity and mortality conferences, and a third by looking at preventable the causes of preventable adverse drug effects. There's a very nice paper by Charles Vincent on understanding, reporting, and responding to adverse events, a sort of way of investigating. We've got the investigation analysis of critical incidents, and the, I don't know why this appeared again. This, you already have the last citation from Wu et al., which was on your slide. Yes, surveys can use both of these, one or another or both. You can capture the wisdom of frontline healthcare workers, the wisdom of crowds, yes, and they can be used in developing transitional country settings. Absolutely, this is potentially a very appropriate technology for any setting. So the answer is all of the above. Which of the following is not self-report? A, surveys completed online. Well, all surveys are completed by a person, so those are self-report, even if they're online. Review of hospital charts. Well, no, this is not. This is a retrospective analysis of a record, So this is not self-report. That's the answer. Interviews and focus groups are both asking people to talk about their own experience. Which statement about reviewing malpractice claims is false? Malpractice claims can be good at finding latent errors. True. Malpractice claims are very representative of the problems in medical care. Well, that's not correct. Relatively few cases become malpractice suits, and so they're not entirely representative, though they do represent, perhaps better, some really serious problems. Malpractice claims are not in a standardized format. True. Malpractice claims provide data from multiple perspectives. True. Which of provider surveys? Yes. Incident reports? Yes. Cohort studies? We didn't talk in detail, but from the last lecture, yes. So all of the above. Incident reporting systems are good for finding latent errors. Yes, they can be. Be the best method for understanding the causes of adverse events. Well, I think that that is probably not true. There are other methods, as we described, that are at least as good. This cannot be said to be the best method. They're also referred to as reporting and learning systems, incident reporting systems, reporting systems, yes. So the answer is A and C are correct. Now, that is the end of my formal presentation, but I would like to take some questions. Question section, and we can talk about some of these questions. Okay, so we have, if you, by the way, if you have questions, oops, oh, I see, okay, thank you, Mai. Mai is helping helping me with this. Oops. I might have done something that I was not supposed to do. Until Mai gives me the screen, wait, let's see. sorry about this. Let's talk about one of these cases. a patient was having a urinary infection and was discharged from the hospital. Following a stent in the urinary tract and cardiac stenting, the patient had a reinfection of the urinary tract leading to acute renal failure and a cardiac block. So I can speculate that there may have been problems in several places. This is obviously a healthcare acquired infection, and urinary stents or urinary catheters. Are a frequent source of infection, either because they were placed in a way that was not sterile or because they are left in too long. Having an active urinary tract infection at the time of discharge could have been a problem. Certainly you would like to have treated that urinary tract infection satisfactorily before discharging the patient. I can imagine that there were might be multiple problems in this case. Uh, Let's see. Is it possible to have your study questionnaire? Yes, you can have all of these slides and download them. There's a point that Philip Michel tested these methods, et cetera, with a Jordanian team, and we found that using focus groups with male and female patients was not helpful. One rule about doing focus groups is that it is almost always better to have a separate focus group with female patients and a separate focus group with male patients, because at least in Western cultures, one group will talk more and you will not get so many contributions from others. So focus groups can be useful. I'm not sure that they would necessarily be useful in the Jordanian setting. I suspect that Jordanians, that a group that was not mixed might be better. So what is an adverse event and how does this differ from a serious adverse event following treatment? This is from David. So an adverse event is simply a patient harm that is caused by medical care. So it's the same thing. There are adverse events that are preventable. In other words, they were caused somehow by medical care that went wrong. In other words, they were caused by an error. So errors, not all errors cause harm or adverse events, and not all adverse events are caused by treatment. Let's see, there's a question that says, is the net in Hopkins secure, and the one who reports the error cannot be tracked? So the net is secure. It is only used within the hospital, and in order to submit a report, you need to use your unique login, the same login that you would use to use the medical record, to use the electronic system. Is you are actually asked to give your name as you are reporting, so you could be tracked. In fact, the point is if the people want additional information from you, that they could contact you. However, I think that people have begun to feel safe about reporting. They see that people are not punished ever for reporting errors. And so we do get a lot of people feel safe. The culture has developed so that people feel like they can report, that it is a good thing to report, and in fact it's rewarded in some cases. I see some cases, and in all of these cases I'm sure there are multiple places where things could have gone wrong. I think that we probably, thinking now, we probably would need more detail about the cases to understand where the problems were, but these would all be good for analysis. Thank you for putting in these cases. After this lecture, I will try to respond to all of them as much as I can. I think the point here that is made, which is when studying an adverse event by observation, we must first consider the ethics, so we must prevent the occurrence of an error first and then record it. And so that's absolutely right. And we talked about the Donchin study last week, and that was a case in which that was a study in which observers were placed at the bedside and watched things happen. And the protocol was, if they noticed something happening, they would immediately tell the staff what had happened, and then they would record what happened. Obviously, you need to first protect the patient. It's not just research. So how to make a reporting system work effectively in a culture culture that will not allow doctors to admit mistakes. So this is a very important point. And I think the first thing to do in this case would be for leaders in the hospital to make an announcement that they would like people to report incidents. And in fact, they can even set top clinical leaders can set examples for describing mistakes that they have made to the other staff. I think the first kind of incident system that you might use is one that is completely anonymous, so that you submit a case without submitting your name. And perhaps having something like this would allow people to become, to feel more secure, to feel more safe about reporting. After this has been in place for a while, perhaps they might feel more comfortable about using a system where their names are attached to the incidents. Why are pharmacists kept away from clinical decision making? That is a professional and philosophical question that I can't give a good answer to. In some cases, anyway, pharmacists have more responsibility than in others. I've worked in Thailand a little bit, and pharmacy staff, in fact, make lots of decisions about what medicines to give to the patients, so at least that I have experienced. Can I have the questionnaire used by Dr. Wu in this house office receiver? Yes, we will make that available. Someone has an undergraduate elective course on patient safety in Kuwait. So some of the validated tools in patient safety research. I can direct you to the WHO patient safety website or the patient safety research website, and we'll be posting as many tools as we can, though this is as we are just beginning this, I don't know that we can post so many things immediately. How can I prevent patient adverse events in a dental clinic? Well, that's a very good question. I think the first thing to understand is either from your own experience or from perhaps some having someone observe for a day or a few days, you might want to decide what your events, what the most common adverse events are, and then investigate one of those and then try to discover what the causes are. And finally, then to try to aim a intervention at those causes. I think we are just about out of time. I have not gotten to look at questions from the Doodle forum. I actually am not seeing queries put through the Doodle forum. If someone later will tell me if I did something wrong, I'd be very interested to know so we can do it better next time. Next week, our lecture 5 will be on identifying solutions to problems. And I'm looking forward to another exciting session. I hope you enjoyed this. As you can see, this is still a little bit of a work in progress. We're learning how to do this. But I was happy that we could at least discuss a few of the questions at the end here today. And again, I will try to look at them offline during the week, and we will post some responses. So thank you all. I think that we will end here. I appreciate your attention. We had well over 100 people participating, and most of you stayed through to the bitter end, so I appreciate your attention. I hope you're enjoying this, and if you have comments or ways that we can improve these sessions, please let us know. Again, we are just starting this effort, so thank you so much. Bye-bye. Also, to people